This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. A virtual room. You, me, the top experts on a big question and 28 minutes. Let's go. This week, COVID. Again. I'm confused. You're probably confused. The shifting regional tier system for virus suppression can feel like the fabled Schleswig-Holstein question, which only three people understood. One of whom is dead, one of whom is mad, and me. And I've forgotten it. But we do need to understand it and its rationale. Why are some places like Liverpool on the highest tier, tier three? Some in tier two, like London is about to be, and still others in tier one. What's put them there? And what actually governs their movement up and, more hopefully, down? And what can local and regional authorities do to affect their fate? Come inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, let's start with what the data tells us. Dr. Michael Tildesley is an epidemiologist at Warwick University. Michael Tildesley, what do we know about how infection rates differ?
Currently, with the infection rates around the UK, the R number that we all talk about is greater than one everywhere. In different regions, they're at slightly different phases of their epidemics. When we went into lockdown back in March, really, it was almost because of London. So London was a little bit ahead of everywhere else. Now it's actually the north of England and the Midlands that are slightly ahead of other regions in the epidemic curve.
Where there are differences, what can we say about them? For example, we've just had news from Northern Ireland, which has had an extremely low level of infection at certain points, and they're now very alarmed. So what can we actually say about the difference in infection rates between the least infected region, let's say, and the most infected regions?
Nationwide, our predictions of R are between about 1.2 and about 1.6. And so, for instance, the R number for the Northwest, we're seeing an R number of maybe between about 1.2 and 1.4. Similarly, in the Midlands, the R number is maybe slightly lower. So the R number really gives us an idea of how the infection is growing. But actually, the way that tiers are based upon in terms of local regions going into restrictions are really based upon the total number of cases per 100,000, the total number of cases as a fraction of the total population in that region. That really gives us an indication of how much infection there is. And crucially, if R is also greater than one, we would expect that sadly cases would continue to increase.
So what we're looking at when we're looking at data to decide whether a place should be in a particular tier is R number plus cases.
Yes, it has to be a combination of R number plus cases.
Now, if we move on from infection rates to talk about what infection rates lead on to, what do we know about the rate of hospital admissions for COVID around the country and how they differ?
They are going up pretty much nationwide. They're going up relatively slowly compared with where we were back in March. The number of daily hospitalizations now is about as high on a national scale as when we went into lockdown in March. But the rate of increase of those hospitalizations is a lot slower.
Do we have any understanding of why that would be?
Back in March, our testing was almost exclusively focused around care homes and hospitals, and they are the people that are much more likely to go to hospital. Now, because our testing capacity is a lot higher, there's a lot more community testing and there's a lot more infection in younger people. When they do get infected, they tend to get much milder symptoms. And therefore, as a proportion of the overall number of cases, the hospitalizations seem to be growing much slower. On a regional basis, we are seeing that where incidence is high, we are tending to see that you're getting slightly more hospitalizations. But actually, the total number of daily hospitalizations nationwide is still relatively low compared with where it was at the peak in April. But of course, the danger is if we follow this trajectory, then in a month or so's time, if we don't take further measures, we could see these climbing quite severely. Certainly, if we look at Liverpool, this is an extreme example of the case. So Liverpool is in tier three and they have very high hospital admissions at the moment. I mean, this is why Liverpool went into tier three. I think a couple of days ago, it was reported that intensive care beds in Liverpool were up to about 95% occupancy. We're already in the phase where probably hospitals are being quite stretched.
Michael, it would seem to follow from that, that one of the things that's happening in Liverpool is that that older age group are indeed now being infected.
This certainly would suggest that this is the case. The younger people might have been infected first, and then the more elderly, the more vulnerable people are sadly becoming hospitalised with the virus.
Now, are hospitals, when we talk about them being stretched in the same way that they were back in March? I mean, in the first instance, for example, what are we seeing with regard to deaths? Sounds cold to ask it that way, but nevertheless, there it is.
The death numbers are still relatively low compared with where they were back in March, April time. I mean, it's very difficult to tease this out on a regional level, actually, because we're still looking at, say, the daily number of deaths, even in the last couple of days, is lower than 150 per day. And we're comparing this with, at the peak, we were looking at about 1,100 per day. So it is slightly increased in areas of concern. But of course, we need to remember that we have better drugs to treat the very ill patients in hospital now compared with what we did back in April. Our NHS are generally better protected. We have more personal protective equipment for the staff. Obviously, the care homes where we have more severe cases potentially are also better protected. So deaths are increasing and more increasing in those areas of concern, but are significantly lower than what they were back in April.
Dr. Michael Tyldesley. That's what's happening in different parts of the country. Now let's zoom in a bit closer and look at the particular settings in which COVID is spreading. Dame Anne Johnson is Professor of Infectious Disease Epidemiology at University College London. She's also co-investigator on Virus Watch, a major population study of COVID-19 transmission. Anne Johnson, one of the terms we're going to use is the term outbreak. What do we actually mean by outbreak?
Well, an outbreak has a very specific definition, and it relates to really where you have two or more test-confirmed cases of COVID-19 within a specific setting outside the home and have illness onset dates within 14 days, and you can have evidence that they've been in contact with one another. And that's what outbreak investigations set about to understand by a kind of form of epidemiological detective work.
Now, what do we know about where outbreaks as so defined are happening?
There's routine data collected by Public Health England, which they report each week. And if you look at those data, they're not all outbreaks. Some of them are just incidents, which is where you think you might have an outbreak and you go and investigate the incident just to complicate things. But amongst these incidents, you will see that the highest number at the moment is in education settings, in care homes, in workplaces, in hospitals and in food outlets. But in addition to whether you have an outbreak, of course, there is the question of how big the outbreak is. So, you know, an outbreak of two people in a bubble in a school is very different from an outbreak with 100 cases in a hall of residence.
Is this partially a factor of the places there where it is easier to measure the fact that there has been what we call an outbreak?
In a closed environment, like a care home or a hospital, it rapidly becomes apparent that you've got cases. And also you have to think about the damage that's going to do, because once you get an outbreak in a care home, it's really important to control it rapidly, because you know we've seen such a high proportion of deaths occurring in care homes as a result of outbreaks. Obviously, you're more likely to identify clusters in those sort of places because you've got a finite group of people in there.
What do we know about the number of outbreaks as defined arising from attendance at hospitality venues, since we've been talking about those a lot?
Well, in fact, if you look at the statistics, there are relatively few. They're a small fraction of the overall number of outbreaks. And part of that reflects they're not closed environments. If you've been into a cafe recently, you'll see that there could be a huge turnover and people may go into multiple places. So it's quite difficult to identify where someone actually got the infection. Of course, the more transmission you've got, such as we have now, it's really quite difficult to track down specifically where people have got their infection from. If you look at the data now, which is available from contact tracing, people are asked where they've been in the last days before they became sick. And if you look at the most common exposures they have, it's going shopping and eating out. But you don't actually know if that's where they've caught it. And to do that, you need to have what's called a control group to compare the exposures of people who've got the infection versus the exposures in people who haven't got infection. And that's a study which is now ongoing within Public Health England. But it's quite difficult to sort that out.
Now, from your description, it seems clear that there are a number of places where you would intuitively expect transmission that you want very much to keep open, and other places where you might intuitively expect transmission which are less of a priority to keep open, like hospitality sectors, of course important for people who work there, and that's why you choose them. Sometimes you just close what you can rather than necessarily the places with the greatest likelihood of transmission.
Well, you can't close care homes and you can't close hospitals. This has been the difficult choice for government about what measures to take. And that has been, I think, why hospitality venues have been focused on.
Is there any significant change in the collection and analysis of data that you would like to see happen that would help us through the rest of this pandemic and possibly any future one?
In terms of data, I think one of the most important things is to get a better understanding of exactly the question you're asking. Where did people acquire the infection? And now the contact tracing programme is asking people, they're doing what they call backward contact tracing, not just the people in the last couple of days that you might have infected while you were infectious and you've been in contact with, but who were you in contact with, or what environment were you in contact with from which you might have caught the virus? And I think trying to collate that data to try and understand key routes of transmission of cases would give us a much better understanding if we have more granular data so that we can most effectively intervene in the ways that you've been asking about.
Professor Anne Johnson. One phrase which recurs hopefully whenever we talk about reducing the spread of the virus is track and trace. There are currently about 100 local track and trace schemes operating. The one in Cumbria has been up and running for 5 months. The Briefing Room's Rosamund Jones spoke to Dr. Susanna Curry, Clinical Director for Cumbria Sexual Health Services at North Cumbria Integrated Care NHS Foundation Trust.
The local track and trace system in Cumbria was set up on the 18th of May 2020. This was 10 days before the national system went live. The Director of Public Health recognised the need to employ contact tracing quickly, and he felt that we could do this in a way that would dovetail and integrate with the national system when that came on board.
And why was your team of sexual health professionals involved?
During the initial stages of lockdown, our service was much reduced due to the hope that people were adhering to the government's advice of reduced contact with others. And so we had staff available to lend their skills in contact tracing at that time. we started with the equivalent of 4 full-time employees in sexual health. As the contact tracing developed locally, environmental health officers were on hand to give advice. People were lending their skills while their day-to-day job had quietened down. There wasn't any additional funding. Within sexual health, the priority for us is the patient with the infection. We need to check that they are well, they get the adequate treatment. And that's something that we adopted with contact tracing for COVID. Your initial interaction with that person is, are they okay? Do they have adequate support? And if they've been advised to isolate, have they got everything they need? Once you have that rapport with a patient, it's much easier to go into the details of those that they've been in contact with. And we always have our preamble of the reasoning why we ask the questions we ask and why we need to know the information. And I think if someone understands, it's less threatening and you're more likely to give an honest answer. We had a really interesting case early on with a young person who hadn't got symptoms from COVID and was continuing to go into work. And it was working with that person to work out why were they not isolating as they'd been advised and what were their barriers. And it transpired that they couldn't afford not to work and they were anxious about what their boss would say. And we were able to work collaboratively with the employer and come to an agreement with them to support that individual. And I really believe that supportive, quick interaction with that person saved a potential outbreak in their place of work.
And that also is testament to the importance of sort of local knowledge, isn't it?
Absolutely. Having a local contact tracing team meant that we could tap into the resources that were available to us, be that volunteers who had come forward to deliver food packages and things like that. I think a major thing that we benefited from was knowing what resources we had available and being able to set up a helpline for local people with guided advice that was appropriate to them because of the local knowledge we had.
What do you think the success of local contact tracing has been in Cumbria?
We are in tier one in Cumbria. I understand that Cumbria is a very different setting to a number of the areas in the north. We do have a rural population, but we do have pockets of high populations. We have industry in Cumbria where transmission could be rapid. And from my experience at the outset of this in May and June, we really did abort outbreaks in our area. And I think people would perhaps be more accepting of the advice if it comes from a local person.
Dr. Susanna Curry, let's try and put this all together. How much might an enhanced local track and trace system be the answer across the entire country? And will the new tier system be effective? To discuss that are Greg Fell, Sheffield's Director of Health, and Wendy Burke, Director of Health for North Tyneside. Greg, you were on the programme earlier in the summer when we were first talking about local lockdowns. Since then, how have the infection rates been looking in Sheffield?
So what a difference a few months makes. Since June, the numbers came right down from about June till about late August, in the order of 20 to 30 to occasionally 40 per 100,000. However, late August and particularly early to mid-September, numbers have gone up. They've gone up steeply. They've gone up everywhere in the country, but they've certainly gone up in Sheffield. As of yesterday, the 7-day incidence was 433 per 100,000. We know this is driven principally by the 18 to 25 population, and we've just welcomed tens of thousands of 18 to 25-year-olds back to Sheffield. They're called students. And I do think, whilst our current numbers are driven by our student population, there is zero chance we will contain that.
And what's the picture in North Tyneside, Wendy?
We've been seeing an increase probably since very early September. We were in single figures, really, over July and August. So our data at the moment is sitting at 237 cases per 100,000 population for the 7-day rate, which equates to about just under 500 positive cases per week. But we don't have a massive student population.
So the student element is important in Sheffield, but not so important in North Tyneside, and yet the pictures are broadly similar. Greg, has this fed through to hospital admissions yet in Sheffield?
Yes. Intensive care units are beginning to be busy, and I think it's fair to say our hospitals are increasingly concerned about that. We're not in the same place as other parts of the country, but sadly that's a matter of time, when not if.
Now, Wendy, is there much variation within your region from one part to another in terms of infection rates, hospital admissions?
There is a bit of variation across the northeast, and that's largely because we've got at least two local authorities that have got a bit more of a rural population. Although I have to say that the rates have been climbing in all local authorities.
Now, I think both your regions are in tier two, aren't they?
Yes.
What changes is that bringing about for you, Wendy?
Actually, it's made very little change for the northeast because of the previous restrictions that had been implemented. We had restrictions implemented on the 18th and the 30th of September. So actually, being in Tier 2 has involved very little change for our residents.
Now, here's the difference. So we haven't had local restrictions in place other than the national guidance, unlike the northeast. So there's a significant impact for people of Sheffield and then South Yorkshire. It gives a really strong signalling message to the public. It's quite a big deal. My sense is the biggest issue for us will be the impact on household transmission. All of the evidence says that's where the business end of this is. The success stands or falls on the basis of the choices that 580,000 individuals make in their private domain.
Right. Do you both know what needs to happen to get you out of Tier 2 and back into Tier 1, or what would happen to push you into Tier 3, Wendy? Are you clear?
No, there's no clarity about escalation or de-escalation for that matter, and that's something that we have highlighted, and it does need to be addressed. I think the public need to see clarity. There needs to be a clear narrative around that.
But Wendy, are you saying you're not clear, let alone the public being clear?
We're not clear what moves you up or down.
Is that the same for you, Greg? Is that you're in the same situation?
Yeah, same. My expectation is that this is a matter of timing and when not if.
What, before you go to Tier 3?
Yes, that's my expectation.
OK, let's talk now about some of the things which you can do locally, which, if rolled out nationally, might help the country get back towards a Tier 1 situation. And you heard Susanna Curry there talk about local track and trace. Can we have that nationally?
Yes, I mean, Dr. Curry nailed it, as far as I'm concerned. For me, the reality is track and trace is operating on a really, really big scale. It has two problems. One is speed. It needs to track and trace people, perhaps more quickly than is happening at the moment. And the second one is reach and depth, which can arguably only be done by people who know their local patches and are able to reach parts of our communities that you just can't reach from a big national service. So it isn't a dichotomy between local or national, it's both, and they both need to work together. We've stood up a local contact tracing service in Sheffield. I think it will be operational this week, actually. It's nowhere near big enough, in staffing and investment-wise, to take over NHS Test and Trace, nor is that our intention. But what we have done is stood up a series of teams that will pick up where NHS Test and Trace has failed to contact people. What we'll also do is something called backwards contact tracing. So instead of looking forward of who has Mr. Smith been in contact with in his infectious period, look backward. Where has Mr. Smith been? And that gets us back to point sources of infection.
What do you think about that, Wendy?
In order for local contact tracing to work, it has to be adequately resourced. And thus far, it has not been. The offer that's on the table of the local enhanced programme doesn't come with any resource currently. And you can't do this without adequate funding. You just can't.
I suppose my next question is this before we move on. If you were to be able to significantly improve your local track and trace, would it actually be significant enough to stop, let's say, what Greg has described as the almost inevitable progression to tier three?
Sadly, the honest answer is at the moment, with the level of infections by itself, right now, track and trace can probably blunt the rate of growth rather than fundamentally solve the problem.
Is that your view, Wendy?
Yes, I completely agree with what Greg's just said. And I think we also need to focus on a raft of other things. You know, how can we influence the behaviour of our residents, of the general public, to do the right thing? How do we engage with communities to get those messages through loud and clear with consistent messages? And of course, you know, changing the rules and regulations nationally doesn't help with that.
During the course of the pandemic, we've done at least a couple of programmes about how public attitudes and compliance have developed. And there was always a big sense that it was important that we were all in this together, that we went into lockdown together and came out of lockdown together in the summer. Now, that's definitely not the situation anymore. Greg, what about the regional aspect of this? I mean, if people in Sheffield see restrictions in Liverpool, are they more likely to think, well, we're not part of the same thing anymore? Or are they likely to derive the message from it, well, that could well be us in a few weeks' time and so on, we're still all in this together? Because what I think I've noticed is not just a degree of confusion, but also a degree of everybody starting to get cross with each other.
Yeah, I think lots of people have noticed the same. The approach we've taken in Sheffield is one of consensus and consent. I'm not convinced that we can solely enforce our way out of this problem. So we've focused on trying to rebuild the consensus, which I think is frayed. In answer to your question, I think there is more of an element of the latter than the former. It's that, yeah, this could happen here.
Greg, one of the conversations we've been having nationally this week is about the possibility of a national circuit breaker, which would mean that everybody, whatever the region, going to tier three together for a few weeks, as I understand it. Wouldn't that make your life simpler?
It would make my life simpler, certainly. I think the national circuit breaker would probably need to be considerably longer than a few weeks to actually get the level of circulating infection down. And even then, I'm not sure it would, to be honest.
What's your view of that, Wendy?
While I can see it's simple and it's clean, it's easy for the public to understand, I think we should not discount the severe impact that that would have on our jobs and local businesses. And I think that would worry me. That is a real issue for us in the Northeast. And I think while, you know, the government have put in some additional support for the economy, it's just not enough. You know, for many people in the Northeast, surviving on 2/3 of the national minimum wage is just not possible. And also, I'm not sure that it would have as much of an impact as we wanted it to have. Like Greg, I think it would need to be for a longer period, really. And, you know, it's a mechanism to suppress the virus. But again, what we would see is, as you loosen those restrictions, then ultimately, over a period of time, you know, we will see a resurgence in infection levels if we haven't got robust test and trace services and all of the other interventions that we need to have in place at the same time.
I want to be really clear about this, if I can. Looking at it from both your regional perspectives, are you both saying the best thing probably that we can do is try and get to a steady state whereby we're all implementing all the sensible things that we know work, we get local track and trace to a significantly better level, rather than going in and out of tiers and circuit breakers?
Yes, I think you're right. I think you're hired, actually. So well done. You've got the job. We'll probably need to get into a conversation about what does long-term adaption look like as well.
Greg Fell with Wendy Burke. And my conclusion is not particularly cheering. Regions differ more in timing than in susceptibility to the virus. And although we should avoid the deaths and health misery of April and May, we face restrictions for some time ahead. Also, while local track and trace is definitely part of a medium-term answer, it won't get us to a COVID-free Christmas. My thanks to Michael Tilsley, Anne Johnson, Susanna Curry, Greg Fell and Wendy Burke. We'll be back next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirsty Knight, Bob Howard and Rosamund Jones. The programme was mixed by James Beard and the editor was Jasper Corbett. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon, but if you enjoyed it, you may find other episodes interesting, including Will the US election be fair? Is Sweden the answer? And what have we learned from 6 months of the virus? You can find them all on BBC Sounds.
Wofür machen heimische Frösche Freudensprünge? Für Mineralwasser von Bad Liebenwerda. Natürlich aus dem Naturpark Niederlausitzer Heidelandschaft. Erhältlich in Naturell, sanft, medium und spritzig. Bad Liebenwerda. Von Natur aus liebenswerter.
Innovation bringt die Welt seit jeher voran, doch sie birgt auch Risiken. In einer Zeit, in der die Welt neue Energielösungen benötigt, stellt sich AXA XL den Risiken. Als einer der führenden globalen Versicherer setzen wir ständig neue Maßstäbe, um die Energiewende zu beschleunigen.
AXA XL. Risiken eingehen für eine Zukunft voller Möglichkeiten. Diese Anzeige stellt weder ein Angebot oder eine Aufforderung dar, noch ist sie eine Beschreibung von Produkten oder Dienstleistungen von AXA XL.